Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for an hour touching on the political battle over funding universal pre-K, a huge swath of Kentucky forest now off limits to development, how some of the apps and new cars can tie into domestic abuse, and we take a ride in a driverless car. The idea of universal pre-K is to ensure any family who wants to enroll their preschool-age child in a publicly funded pre-kindergarten care and education program has the opportunity to do that. Competing budget proposals in the current session of the Kentucky legislature are clear in their differences. Governor Beshear proposes spending $172 million a year for universal pre-K. The budget proposed by House Republicans does not include funding for universal pre-K. What's at stake? Bridget Blom looks into that in this latest in our series on public education.
Today, we're grappling with a concerning trend in Kentucky's early learning landscape. Fewer than half of Kentucky's children are entering kindergarten, prepared to succeed, and Kentucky's national ranking for preschool enrollment has declined from 24th in 2006 to 39th currently. In order to ensure more little learners are ready, Kentuckians need more access to affordable, high-quality early care and education programs. Tirelessly advocating for this core principle, Dr. Dan Worry, Senior Director of Early Learning at the Hunt Institute, has devoted his career to shaping impactful early childhood education initiatives. A former kindergarten teacher and school district administrator, Dan served as Deputy Director of South Carolina First Steps to School Readiness, the state's comprehensive public-private early learning initiative. In this role, he worked alongside elected leaders to develop significant bipartisan support for early childhood education and oversaw system innovations, including the delivery of public preschool in private, community, and faith-based programs. Recognized as South Carolina's 2018 Champion for Children, and past president of the South Carolina Early Childhood Association, Dr. Worry's influence continues to shape the landscape of early education. Dr. Worry, it's an honor to have you on Eastern Standard.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm so glad to be here.
Dr. Worry, your transition from a kindergarten teacher to a senior director at the Hunt Institute reflects a remarkable journey. How has your classroom experience shaped your approach to spearheading early learning initiatives at a system level?
Oh, gosh, you're absolutely right about the journey. In fact, the piece maybe that you don't have of that puzzle is that my professional journey actually began even earlier than that. My very first experience in early childhood education was in a child care setting, in an hourly sort of entry level position in an after school program. I also worked for a year while waiting to get into grad school as a paraprofessional in an elementary school. And so, you know, we describe the early childhood career ladder, if you will. And I have had the good fortune, I think, to work at most every rung of that, from a very entry level sort of position, to a public school teacher, to a school district administrator. I had the good fortune, as you mentioned, to lead South Carolina's early childhood system for many years, and now have this wonderful opportunity to inform policy across the country at the Hunt Institute. And so bringing that real life boots on the ground experience is to me a really special part of it. You know, the other piece is that I've experienced the system as a parent, as a consumer. My family spent the better part of a decade paying more for a high-quality childcare program than for our mortgage, for example. And so those are all perspectives that I have luckily been able to bring to this work at the Hunt Institute.
Some might say you've lived and breathed your entire career in early childhood, but you're bringing that on-the-ground experience to systems-level thinking. So as you advise states across the nation and have South Carolina, how do you bring that lived experience to the system level, and what are some of the principles you use to help folks understand what the system needs to provide and deliver?
at the system level, fundamentally, we need to understand just the importance of the early years for one. And I think that's a, you know, that's a place that I think the public has landed at this point. In fact, it's really remarkable to look at the polling across the country about early childhood education and watch what voters are doing. You might have followed the story out of New Mexico here as they passed here in November of 2022 a constitutional amendment to enshrine early childhood funding in the state's constitution. You know, on that particular day in November, Governor Lujan Grisham, who is the state's Democratic governor, was also up for re-election. 70% of the vote, though, was cast in favor of expanded early childhood funding, while Governor Lujan Grisham comfortably advanced to a second term with only 52% of that vote. And so, you know, the major takeaway here is that, you know, across the country and across partisan lines, voters and policymakers are really starting to step up on this topic. But there's definitely a disconnect right now between what we know and what we do. We have a long way to go still in terms of investment in high quality programs and how to implement them well.
And Dan, would you say there's a disconnect in voters, in communities, policymakers, really understanding the problem that we're trying to remedy with early childhood as a solution? And by that, I mean, as an example, in Kentucky, we have three things going on. We have declining education outcomes across the board from, you know, elementary into middle and high school. And then we have a lagging workforce participation rate, one of the worst in the nation. And at the same time, we have a lack of affordable childcare. So is it your sense that folks understand how those three things connect and how early childhood can be the solution to those three problems?
That's a great question. And I think that speaks a little bit to the disconnect, because I do think at some level, intellectually, people do increasingly understand those connections, but we're not always seeing it reflected in policy. I mean, you know, one piece of the puzzle, as you know, as we struggle at the state level with, you know, outcomes in the K-12 education system, our public policy around childcare, for example, is really out of step with what we know from decades of brain science, right? That we think in many cases of childcare being sort of separate and distinct from education, right? That learning begins when children go to kindergarten at age 5. And what we know from the science is that that is categorically not the case, right? That young children are actually learning, believe it or not, in utero. You know, the children who are, you know, just hours old are able to distinguish and prefer the native language of their mothers, for example. They recognize lullabies and even TV theme songs in some cases that they were regularly exposed to in utero. And so we know that children are not just learning from day one, but even before birth. And so I think the time has come that we really need to re-examine our views on what we will call quote unquote childcare and recognize it as the very important learning environment that it is. And, you know, to your other points, the impact on the, you know, the workforce, the economy, you know, the long-term prosperity of Kentucky in this case, but also the short-term prosperity. I don't know, Brigitte, if you saw our colleagues at a group called Ready Nation put out a report not long ago that looked at the drain on the American economy created by lack of high-quality infant-toddler programs. They estimate this at $122 billion, with a B, dollars annually. And $1.2 billion of that, by the way, is what they estimate is lost each and every year in Kentucky as a result of lack of infant-toddler, you know, high-quality infant-toddler programs. So, you know, this has a bearing on the productivity of employers, the profitability, tax revenue coming into the states, and certainly the earnings of parents who frequently have to lose or forego earnings as a result of the childcare challenges that they're facing. So these, you know, all of the three problems that you outlined as a challenge that Kentucky is currently grappling with, I would point to proactive investment in early childhood education as the solution.
Yeah. And it's an interesting point that you make with infant and toddler care, Dan. In Kentucky, in a recent poll, the findings show that over 30% of Kentucky working families made a change to their job status because of lack of childcare. So not only is it an issue with workforce participation in getting folks meaningfully attached to the workforce, but it's also becoming a declining area of participation in the state because of a lack of childcare. So there's a bit of a 1-2 punch there that we need to pay close attention to. And that 0-4 population is critically important to pay attention to as we have conversations about both preschool and childcare and the importance
Absolutely.
Of both. So I want to zero in on the preschool piece for a minute. The integration of public preschool into other education settings was a significant innovation during your time as deputy director in South Carolina. How did this approach impact access to early education, particularly for underserved communities? And what were some of the challenges you encountered in implementing this innovation?
What we're talking about ultimately is what we in the field call mixed delivery. And what that means is, you know, the mixed part of mixed delivery is that there is a wide variety of public and private providers that have an opportunity to participate in the service delivery. So it's not just public schools. It is, private childcare providers. It is Head Start programs. It is faith-based preschools in many cases. And the truth is that this mixed delivery concept is absolutely critical to the overall ecosystem in early childhood. I think it's important to say up front, there's really very little question that school district pre-kindergarten programs, by and large, are fantastic. The challenge with them, though, is caused by the economics of childcare. And so, if you know anything about how childcare works from a fiscal point of view, infant care in particular is so costly to provide. You can serve so few babies to one adult that it is almost impossible to even break even, much less turn a profit in those infant and toddler classrooms with very small staff to child ratios. And so childcare providers depend very heavily on the presence of 3- and 4-year-old children who can be served in larger groups to remain solvent even as businesses. And so, there is a real existential threat to the childcare industry associated with states going too heavily into public sector service provision. And that's why we in South Carolina chose this mixed delivery system. The other thing that occurs to me, I think the value of the private sector has shown itself over and over in South Carolina, but was especially evident during COVID, where, a lot of our school district programs were shut down or virtual for the better part of a year, whereas our private sector providers, who in their day-to-day work were providing service to essential employees, managed to keep those classrooms running. They also managed to provide wraparound care before school hours, after school hours, a full day. When we talk about full day kindergarten or pre-kindergarten at the school district level, typically we're talking about 6.5 hours, which is, far short of what most full-time employed parents have to find coverage for, just to work in their own jobs. And so in addition to the fact that the participation of these private sector providers helps to ensure the ongoing availability of infant and toddler care in our communities, it helps families on all of those other fronts as well.
If somebody asks you, Dr. Worry, is it preschool or is it childcare that we need to focus on? How do you respond?
I would tell you there is no distinction between the two. I think, one, it's difficult at the policy level because, when we talk about early childhood education, we're talking about a really diverse sort of ecosystem, right? Kindergarten and pre-kindergarten and Head Start and childcare. And so the conversation can become confusing when we refer to everything as early childhood education. But the truth is that childcare is very much early childhood education. In fact, you know, arguably outside of the home, perhaps the most critical learning environment, you know, in all of human development. We know that the years from, you know, from prenatal to three in particular are the single most consequential period in all of human development. It is where the, you know, the fundamental architecture of the brain is wired in ways that will help to promote or hinder long-term success for many, many years to come. And so, you know, the sooner we sort of break down this artificial divide between education and childcare, which in reality just doesn't exist, the better off we will be.
Dr. Dan Worry, your dedication to early childhood education and your notable achievements in South Carolina and nationally serve as an inspiration for us. I'm really grateful for your time with us here on Eastern Standard. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Nature Conservancy in Kentucky, Kentucky Fish and Wildlife, and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation recently announced what they describe as the largest conservation easement in Kentucky history. It's on the nearly 55,000-acre Cumberland Forest Wildlife Management Area in Bell, Knox, and Leslie counties. And to find out what this means, we turn to David Femister, State Director for the Nature Conservancy in Kentucky. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, David.
Well, Tom, it's great to be back. It's been about 4 years since I was in here talking to you about the deal that sort of made this present deal possible.
Right. It was a pre-pandemic, and a lot of time has gone by, and so now that has become a reality. First, let's do some terminology. What is a conservation easement?
Yeah, conservation easement, just to go back to the very basics, you know, property rights can be thought of as a bundle of sticks, and an owner of those rights can keep all the sticks or they can give them, sell them to other holders. And a conservation easement is when one entity gives or sells their development rights and certain management rights to another entity. And typically, holders of those easements are nonprofits like the Nature Conservancy or state and federal agencies, like in this case, the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources. So it's a way to permanently protect property without actually transferring the underlying title ownership interest.
Okay, so that consortium of organizations doesn't actually own the property now, but
yes, they own certain rights. So they own the development rights. Those are, I guess you could say, extinguished by the easement. They own or have control over subdivision of the property and other uses of it. But yes, they don't own the underlying fee interest.
Okay. In your press release about this, you say that it's hard to overstate the size and significance of this conservation effort. Why are its size and its significance so important to understand?
Yeah, I have been saying this is a big deal, and it's a big deal really for three reasons. One, just the sheer size of it. You mentioned at the outset, 55,000 acres. It's the biggest conservation easement in state history. And to give people a little bit of perspective on that, that's about 30% the size of all of Fayette County, where we're sitting today doing this interview. So it's a really big chunk of land, and those opportunities to conserve big pieces of ground, especially in the eastern United States, are really few and far between. So this is significant just for the size. It's also really significant and a big deal because of its location. The property is located right in the heart of the Cumberland Pine Mountain Corridor, which is itself just a part of this larger Appalachian Corridor, which stretches from northern Alabama all the way to Canada. And I think a lot of people might be surprised to know that the Appalachians are globally important as hardwood forests. They're globally important for biodiversity. And they're also increasingly important as a migration corridor. As the climate changes, wildlife and even tree and plant species are moving their ranges north. and having that connected corridor is really essential.
When we think about a forest, we talk about it in terms of acreage and property, but how will this easement protect the living ecosystems of the forest, the fish and wildlife habitat, for example?
No, that's right. And that was a big, obviously, interest for Kentucky Fish and Wildlife, who is responsible for managing our game and non-game wildlife species here in the state. And so this is important for species as iconic as the restored populations of eastern elk and black bear, to the things you might have to look a little harder for, salamanders, insect populations, neotropical migratory birds. So it's really just a very important place for wildlife. It's also important for people. You know, one of our goals with the Cumberland Forest Project has been to connect the local communities to these lands. And this easement is not just a conservation easement, it's a public access easement. So for now, until the end of time, the citizens of Kentucky, visitors to Kentucky, are going to have access to this property for outdoor recreation. And we think that's really important on any number of fronts.
Well, that was one of the big things I was curious about, the public access. How exactly will that work?
Yeah, so as of right now, the property is open for public visitation and public use. I would say there's incredible potential there that we're still working to fully build out with our partners at Kentucky Fish and Wildlife. We're in the final stages of putting together a recreational management plan for the property, and that will, you know, help set the overall vision for how this big diversity of land is going to be used for a variety of uses, from hunting to hiking to mountain biking. There will even be opportunity for off-road vehicle use done in a responsible fashion on maintained roads on the property.
So this would actually establish entry points, a place you can drive to, park your car, and
exactly right, exactly right. And if people are interested in knowing where it is right now, it's in Leslie, Bell, and Knox County. And in Bell County, if you just head out on Highway 74 out of Middlesboro, as soon as you get up into the hills on either side of 74, that's the property. And you'll see, you know, little roads on occasion heading off from Highway 74. And any of those, if your car can get up them, you're welcome to come explore the property.
How was the easement funded? How did that work out?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it gives us, or gives me, a chance to thank our many partners on this project, because a deal this big, it's obviously much bigger than just the Nature Conservancy alone. So we had funding from a couple of sources. One, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation got a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and that helped us with some of the funding. But the bulk of it came from two sources. One, federal funds through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And we had those federal funds available to Kentucky Fish, but they needed a match. These federal funds require a 25% match. So 2 years ago, we went to the Kentucky General Assembly and started having conversations with our elected officials about the importance of this property, this sort of unique opportunity to bring it into permanent public conservation. And right away, folks really seemed to understand the importance, get that message. And Senator Brandon Smith was an incredible champion, as was Robin Webb there in the Senate, Adam Bowling on the House side, Senate President Stivers. Had a lot of champions up there who I think, again, recognized it as important for conservation, but also important for people. And so the Kentucky General Assembly provided $3.875 million in state funds to match those federal funds. And that was just essential to get the deal done.
And I'm guessing that those legislative leaders probably also saw implications for the local economy.
They did. They did. You know, when you're talking with folks and trying to influence someone to support something you're interested in, you know, I always think it's important to meet people where they are. And I think what we heard in the General Assembly is, one, there's a lot of pride in the beauty and resources of eastern Kentucky. There's also a lot of focus on diversifying the economy. And we're very humble on this front. This project, nature-based tourism overall, is not going to solve all of the challenges that we experience in rural America, including in eastern Kentucky. But nature-based tourism, outdoor recreation can be a part of that solution. And I think elected officials saw that and saw this property having exceptional potential on that front.
Slightly off topic, we're interested in reclaiming former mine land in eastern Kentucky. And I know that the Nature Conservancy has been working to restore forests to some of these sites. How has that work been going?
It's been going really well. Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that because there's been a lot going on this Cumberland Forest property. Obviously, this conservation easement is the big headline. It's the thing we're most excited about, most proud of. But lots of other good work has been happening as well, and that includes mine land reforestation. We've done close to 250 acres of reforestation. That's been in partnership with Green Forest Works, which is an organization based here in Lexington that has really perfected how you do reforestation on these old mine sites. And we've done a big planting of about 160,000 trees in Bell County, and then we did another property up there in Leslie County. And there's great interest in doing it. It's a great story. We've had a lot of philanthropic interest and support for it. One of the challenges, Tom, is getting these sites fully released from their bond obligations, because I think we have a lot more potential to do more of this reforestation work on Cumberland Forest and elsewhere in Appalachia. But the property's got to be fully cleared out of bond before you can do that. And that's been one of our biggest hurdles.
On the easement property, have there been logging operations? Do you anticipate that happening?
Yeah, there have been and there will continue to be. You know, one of our goals when we set up the whole Cumberland Forest project back in 2019 was that these were going to be working and productive lands, so both good for nature but also good for local economies. And sustainable forestry is a part of that. When we talked back in 2019, one of the things we were most immediately focused on was getting the whole 253,000 acres of the property, 55 in Kentucky and the rest in Tennessee and Virginia, getting that into Forest Stewardship Council certification. And so that's the gold standard for how we can manage our forests sustainably so they can provide a renewable resource in timber and fiber, but still maintain their ecological integrity and value as wildlife habitat.
Well, when will we be able to take a walk in these woods?
Well, we can set that up anytime you would like. And again, this is sort of a view of the woods as opposed to a walk in them. As I said, there's areas you can access right now. But if the just member of the general public wants to get a sense of the scope and scale, if you go to Cumberland Gap National Park there outside of Middlesboro and go up to the Pinnacle Overlook, the land that you're looking out on in the immediate foreground is Fern Lake, which I can say the Conservation Fund and the Nature Conservancy also recently protected. But beyond Fern Lake, those mountains all across the background of your view, that's Cumberland Forest. So it's a great, beautiful vista, and it gives you a sense of the scope and scale of this project.
It also reminds us of what an incredible place this state is, huh?
It is. And again, I would come back to that. I remember sitting in Senate President Robert Stiver's office, and he has a big poster on his wall of just an iconic view of the eastern Kentucky mountains. And you could see how proud he was of that and how a lot of folks have maybe an image of eastern Kentucky that maybe is not as positive. And we really need to get that story out, that this is a beautiful part of the country with great resources. And what we talked to President Stivers about is we need some of that land to be accessible to the public. That's how we make those ties and connections. And that's what this deal is going to allow us to do.
All right. This is David Femister, State Director for the Nature Conservancy in Kentucky. And thank you so much, David.
Tom, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for having me in.
Coming up after the break, how apps in cars can be abused and a ride in a driverless taxi cab. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, February 1st, the Franklin County Council on Aging Incorporated in Frankfort will host Kentucky Chautauqua, William Wells Brown, How I Got My Name. The show will begin at 10:15 a.m. On Friday, February 2nd, Equus Run Vineyards in Midway will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Henry Clay, Divided We Stand. The performance will begin at 6:30 p.m. And on Saturday, February 3rd, the Jessamine County Public Library in Nicholasville will host Speakers Bureau, Singing in the Spirit, the African-American sacred music tradition presented by Kathy Bullock. The talk will begin at 1 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
There is lots to talk about when it comes to the privacy and personal security issues raised by today's digital environment. Smart devices seem to be everywhere. Adam Dodge focuses on preventing online abuse. He's founder of NTAB and is an internationally recognized digital safety expert who believes that you don't have to be a tech expert to stay safe in this digital age. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
And first, what brought you into this work? I know you had been a family law attorney. Why did you turn to this work?
Well, as a family law attorney, you also deal with a lot of domestic violence and dating violence cases, and that really called to me. So I ended up leaving the family law profession and focusing on working with victims of abuse in the nonprofit sector. And as a consequence of doing that work for almost 10 years, the ways in which technology is weaponized and misused to harm victims today just became ubiquitous. And I found that myself and my colleagues didn't really have a good handle on how to act when a victim was reporting that they were being harmed online or through their devices. So I chose to leave a job that I love to start NTAB to educate my fellow victim service providers and judges and law enforcement and the military on how to prevent and address digital violence today.
In your interaction with clients, do you get a sense that many, maybe most actually, most of us just don't fully understand how exposed we are to online abuse?
That's right. You're exactly right. The reality is our safety instincts, our fight, flight, or freeze instincts that work and serve us so well in the physical world, don't work so great in the digital realm when those threats aren't easily perceived and we don't react in a certain way. It sort of happens very insidiously and in the shadows. So we're not often aware that it's even happening. And when it does, we don't react in the same way to a digital threat that we do to a threat to our physical safety. So there's a real disconnect there.
Well, what can you tell us about how technology, and this particular technology, is used as a tactic in abuse?
The reality is that all cars have computers in them now. And as a feature offered by automakers, app connectivity is a selling feature. And these are designed to be convenient to us, to help us find our cars, unlock our cars, turn the heat on before we get in the car. But that convenience comes at a cost when it comes to gender-based violence and stalking by current or former partners, because it gives those abusive individuals power and control over a victim's vehicle, and they can't readily turn off the location tracking or get rid of the car much in the same way they would, let's say, a smart device or a phone or a tablet that was tracking.
And what about the responsibility of the automaker? Has there been a problem in getting the automaker to help turn off those tracking devices or to help in some way?
Unfortunately, yes. This is a fairly new issue for them, although I don't think it should be. I think this is a very foreseeable turn of events. But what we found in working with victims and survivors of this kind of car app stalking is that automakers are either unwilling or unaware of how to terminate the abusive party's access to the vehicle, even in circumstances where the victim has a restraining order, a protective order, granting them exclusive use to the car, and that orders the restrained party not to track them, and even in some situations where the victim is the co-owner of the car. So it's a very troubling situation that automakers can easily address, but so far have been unable or unwilling to do so.
What about those smartphone AirTags that, you know, that we can hook up to key rings or to luggage to find them when they're lost? Is this technology also being used abusively?
Absolutely. AirTags, when they first were announced by Apple, those of us in the victim serving community were deeply concerned because this was just another tool for in the toolkit for people who want to track and monitor victims without their consent. And in our opinion, at the time of release, they didn't really do a good job of alerting victims or preventing a stalking in those situations. They've made some changes since then. The difference between AirTags is that they're possible to locate. We can locate and find them and remove them. But with automobiles, it's either forego the access to your vehicle, which is critical to surviving and thriving today, or continue to drive that vehicle with the knowledge that you're being tracked.
Well, let's say somebody listening to us is going through this and they want to know how to disable that tracking. Is it at all possible for an individual to figure out how to do it?
Well, I'm going to give you a very lawyerly answer, Tom. It depends. It depends on the automaker. It depends on the app. It depends on the situation. So in some circumstances, yes, from, let's say, the touch panel within the car, you can turn off location tracking. But in other cases, there's no ability to do so, or the victim is prevented from doing so because they are not the primary owner of the vehicle or something like that. So it's very challenging for those victims in those situations. It's a total grab bag. And that unpredictability is not what victims want to find themselves in when they're fleeing an abusive incident.
Well, this car tracking issue is chilling, and there's a great New York Times article that encompasses this particular abuse that actually that's where I found out about you, Adam. You're quoted there. And so I'm going to put a link to that article on our site so that you can dig further into that. In the meantime, while I've got you, I want to ask you some other questions about safety online, beginning with passwords. What do we need to know about password safety?
I will say it's very hard in my trainings to make the topic passwords interesting to folks, but it really is very critical to our digital safety. The average person has over 100 apps and online accounts, but the average person is not able to memorize over 100 unique passwords for each account. What they end up doing is reusing passwords. And that puts them in an unsafe situation because if somebody has access to one password, they have access to multiple accounts. So what we recommend folks do is use what's called a password manager, which creates really powerful, unique passwords for each of your individual accounts. And you only have to remember one password to your password manager. This way, if there's a data breach or something happens where your password leaks into the internet or the dark web and somebody gets a hold of it, they're not able to access your other accounts because you're not reusing that password. So password managers are really sort of the top choice for us when it comes to password safety.
Now, when we encounter harassment on social media, it seems the almost default response is to block the abuser. But is that the best way to put a stop to it?
Well, that's historically been the response from most folks. If you're experiencing online harassment, well, just block that person. Just block that person. And there's a couple reasons that that advice can be problematic. One, we're putting the onus on the victim, right? Instead of putting the onus on the person harming the victim, we're focusing on the victim's behavior. Well, just block this person instead of trying to figure out who's doing this and how to stop it. The other problem with blocking someone is, well, let me give you an example. If a bad actor is harassing somebody anonymously online and they become blocked on social media, let's say Instagram, do you think they throw up their hands and say, oh, game over, checkmate, you got me. I've been blocked. I guess I can't harass you anymore. Or will that person simply create a new account or maybe several new accounts to continue their campaign of harassment on the victim? So blocking actually sometimes has the unintended consequence of creating more problems for a victim. And luckily, there are different alternatives to blocking today that victims can avail themselves to.
Well, I think this whole thing kind of gives any aversion to paranoia a run for its money. And this next question goes to that. Home smart devices, you know, Amazon Echo, Google Nest, can they be used to eavesdrop?
I get asked this question a lot. And the reality is it's pretty rare. It's exceedingly rare that a bad actor is using a smart speaker to spy on you. That being said, there has been some limited news that it's come out recently that advertisers have boasted that they can listen in on somebody, a customer, using a smart speaker, and then use that information to target them with ads, which would explain why we get, let's say, shoe ads in our feed or on our computers when we've just talked to a friend saying we need new shoes.
Thank you for bringing that up. I was afraid to say that I've seen that happen. Absolutely.
That's sort of a universal experience for most folks. But for victims and survivors of abuse or someone who's worried that they're being stalked, the likelihood that the smart devices in their homes, the thermostat, the smart speaker, the smart TV are being weaponized and misused against them is very rare. The one smart device that I would say is important to make sure you lock down in your home is any kind of smart doorbell that you may have, especially if you used to share a home with somebody and they had access to that smart doorbell as well, that's got a camera in it and can record things. That's something you definitely want to make sure that you're updating the password and ensuring that nobody else has access to that and home security, which is, back in the day, it used to be a big deal to get cameras around your house and monitor them. But now the price point has come down so far and the technology is so good that lots of folks have security systems now. And if a current or former partner has or had access to those systems, it really puts your privacy at risk. So making sure that you're updating the passwords in the two-factor authentication on those devices is a really positive step in the right direction.
Well, Adam, I'm curious, in your work, what sort of digital technology abuse concerns you the most?
There's a lot of issues out there. I am a bit of a futurist when it comes to digital safety, so I'm often thinking about emerging issues that are coming out, which is why I focused on this car tracking concern. But other technologies that have my attention are usually driven by artificial intelligence, in particular, the ability to generate intimate or nude images of anyone at any time that look hyper-realistic. So creating these photos or fake nude videos and falsely inserting a victim into those images and then posting them on the internet or threatening to share them is something that is concerning me. And it's very difficult, next to impossible, to prevent from a technological standpoint, because all somebody needs is your headshot from your LinkedIn profile or a photo they find of you on the internet. The other technologies driven by AI or artificial intelligence that have my attention are the ability to impersonate people online. So catfishing, which is really a concern for children, adults, and older folks when it comes to online scams, especially romance scams. People can clone voices. They can create fake photos. They can really make themselves appear to be really however they want to be. And it's usually designed to be interesting or attractive to the person that they're targeting. And we really need to be raising the alarm that the people that we meet online can easily appear to be whoever they want. And we need to approach these online interactions with a healthy skepticism and be careful about what we share with people that we meet online that we don't know offline, and then take steps to verify identities, whether that's asking them to send a quick selfie of themselves in 30 seconds in a certain pose just to prove that they are who they say they are. Or just being inquisitive and looking up their social media profiles to see if they actually have a legitimate one. But healthy skepticism is the foundation for any safe online interaction.
All right. That's Adam Dodge, founder of the online security organization EndTab. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Recently, I spotted a YouTube video posted by Reggie Van Stockham, the Shelbyville-based lawyer, teacher, biologist, writer, and all-around explorer who joins us from time to time, usually telling us about his latest trek to some remote corner of Kentucky. But this time, Reggie was on the other side of the country, in San Francisco.
I'm about to take a driverless robot taxi. Yes, with my son, Philip. So let's go inside and tell the driver where we're headed. Oh, I'm sorry, there's no driver.
Hello, from Waymo. As we get going, just give us 1 minute to cover a few riding tips.
Yikes. So, Reggie Van Stockham, we don't have these here in Kentucky, yet anyway, so I thought it would be fun and interesting and maybe a little scary to get your impression of what that was like.
It was rather space agey, I gotta say that, but it was very comfortable and I felt quite secure. It was a fine ride, I must say.
Well, you know, as I was riding along with you, as you will, in the video, and we're sitting in the back seat, and you're seeing the steering wheel turn, and there's a robotic voice, but there's a lot of traffic going on. It's kind of a sweaty palm experience. Maybe you get used to it, but was it that way for you?
Well, I think the word I would use was creepy, because as you take off, the car pulls out into the lane, and the wheel starts turning, and you lean forward to look in there, and there's nobody turning that wheel. It takes a little getting used to.
So did you feel safe?
Yeah, I did. It wasn't moving very fast to start with, for sure, although on my journey, it got up to as much as 35 miles an hour, and that's plenty fast. But, yeah, it was quite discreet in its movements, rather, shall I say, intelligent in its operation. You can see what it sees in between the two front seats in the back. There's a screen, and on that screen, it shows you everything that it's recording that's around it. So it shows people, cars, everything that's moving around it, and you can see what their sensors see, and that makes you feel pretty good.
Well, one of the scary points I would think would be when you come to an intersection, be it a four-way stop or stoplights, and did you kind of wonder, okay, is it going to stop? Is it going to stop?
There was one or two times where, a car might pull out from a parking spot, or a car might go a little bit farther into an intersection just as a light changes than you would expect or want to see. But the car would move appropriately in reaction to that, and you could see the reaction of your car and the other car on that screen in between the seats.
What do you think? Do robot taxis have a future?
I think they do have a future. They're going to be cost competitive. They're not going to replace the kind of interaction you get with a human driver who can tell you about what you're seeing and answer questions that you might have about the area. I mean, cabbies are pretty important in cities to me. And just the day before, I had hailed one in North Beach, just literally saw it coming down the road, stepped into the road, raised my hand, and he pulled right on in. And we had a delightful discussion as he drove me back to where I had begun. So I think there's probably a place for both of them. But there is almost a security feeling knowing that you've got one of these computer cars coming to get you. On your app that you have on your smartphone, it will show you where the car is and when it's coming to pick you up. On the top of the car, there is a little light, and it'll have your initials on it. It's really a big deal, and I think it is definitely going to catch on, although there are still kinks. There was a second a competitor company in California that had an unfortunate incident. And as a result, that company currently, as I understand it, is not operating in California as they review the procedures, and the state reviews those procedures. But this was the Google car I was in. And I kind of found it, I found it relaxing, actually. But, you know, I don't know that it's much more private. That's the concept that you get when you sit into these things. Hey, it's just me and my son. There's no driver. We can relax. We can chat. You can talk about what we want. And apparently that's the case, except that when these cars first started to operate as taxis, you know, people would get in the back seats and perform acts of hanky-panky. And I will say this, that robot taxi ain't going anywhere if you don't have your seatbelt on.
Well, Reggie Van Stockham, always a pleasure to hear about your journeys and your explorations, and this one in particular. So thanks so much, and we'll have you back soon.
Tom, it's a pleasure visiting with you folks. You be well until next time.
Just a quick mention about something we're launching next week.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in.
Joshua Douglas, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor and host of our election season series, Democracy Optimist, will begin next week, February 1st, with Kentucky's Republican Secretary of State, Michael Adams.
You know, the most frustrating thing about this job is dealing with misinformation. And the most frustrating thing about dealing with misinformation is every time you debunk a theory, those people retreat and they come back with another theory. And then they don't ever acknowledge that you just proved them 20 times before. They just act like it's a brand new conversation.
And Michigan's Democrat Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson.
We need all citizens to be critical consumers of information. Fact check any information you have with nonpartisan sources and speak with trusted voices in your community and election officials when you have questions about your elections.
And to help you prepare for those election season conversations, we'll include an election law of the day, a fun election fact, and one thing you can do to support democracy. Democracy Optimist, an Eastern Standard and WEKU special series in partnership with Dynamics Productions, will be available for listening on air, online streaming, and as a podcast series on Spotify and Apple Music. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.